How many of you guys know my full name? Kevin something something. That's not quite correct. Wait, shh, shh, shh. Kevin Miller, not my full name. Theodore, no. Not my middle name. That would be cool, though. Christopher. Kevin Christopher Miller. That is my full name. But here's the thing. I earned a nickname when I was growing up because I couldn't pronounce my own name. I don't know if you guys had that problem when you were growing up, but I could not pronounce my own name. So would you guys like to know what I called myself? Not Kevin Christopher Miller. I called myself Teto Tifto Moto. When people ask me my name, Teto Tifto Moto, that's what I called myself. So sometimes I still get called that by my mom. She loves to bring that up to me, as I also enjoy, as you could imagine. I've told you a few of the names that I, the nicknames that I earned for myself when I was on a mission trip to Nicaragua. Some of you guys may remember them. One was Goliath, which is Spanish for Goliath. Another was Gigante, which is Spanish for giant. And then the third, your favorite, was Lapis Alto, which means tall pencil. So I obviously earned those for a reason. They thought I was insanely huge. You should have seen me. 6'5" white guy walking around in Nicaragua. I stuck out like a sore thumb in Nicaragua. It was pretty incredible. Now I sent out a few emails today. I sent one out to the staff here at Calvary, and I also sent one out to the Velocity leaders. And I was asking them, I asked each group specific, you know, some of the nicknames that they got when they were growing up. And I got about 26 emails back, people telling me different nicknames that they had and that kind of thing. I found out that our good old Courtney's on, right back there in the back. He grew up with the name of Buck, or better known as Bucky Beaver. So that was a nice one. You can ask him about how he got that one. Jen, my beautiful wife, she was also known as Turkey Hunter.
What?
Now, we're not quite sure why that is, because she's never hunted a turkey one time before in her life. And why anyone would ever call her that, I have no idea. But her dad called her Turkey Hunter. One person that wanted to remain nameless, she learned to, before she started crawling, she started hopping. So her family called her Toad. And to this day, they still call her Toady because she didn't know how to crawl originally. Another one that will also remain nameless, grew up with, I don't know, I guess you could say a runny nose or problems in the nasal compartment. And so her mom called her Booger Face. So I don't know if that was a term of endearment or what. I don't exactly know. And then Josh Rickett, who is up here leading worship for us, tonight, he developed a nickname when he was in fourth grade. And of course his name is Josh Rickett, so they called him Cricket. Mainly because, I think partly because it rhymed with Rickett and cricket, but also he said because he was small and made a lot of noise, just like a cricket. So he earned the nickname of Cricket. That was very nice. So each of us, and maybe you guys, I'm sure many of you guys have your own names that you would love to tell me. I'd love to hear after service at some point. But we've all done certain things at certain points in our lives that have earned us a nickname. Or something that somebody calls us for whatever reason. One of the guys emailed me today on the Calvary staff, and he said, "You can call me El Conquistador." And I was like, that's creepy. I probably won't do that. But our seventh disciple, his name is Thomas. As you can see, he's kind of a interesting-looking man and looks very skeptical, as you can tell. But he also did something to earn a nickname. How many of you guys know what Thomas's nickname is? Does anybody know? Kev? Doubting Thomas. Doubting Thomas. And we're going to look at why that is a little bit later on and kind of go a little more in depth with that. But we're going to learn tonight about how Thomas was a passionate pessimist. Okay, now let me define that word pessimist to you. First, we'll start with its opposite, Its antonym, which is optimist. Okay, the word optimist basically means someone who has a positive outlook and finds the good in things. In other words, the glass is half full. Have you guys heard that description before? When you have a glass, if you're an optimist and it's halfway down, then if you're an optimist, it's halfway full. Now, if you're a pessimist, like Thomas is tonight, then the glass would be halfway empty. And that's defined as someone who has a bad outlook on life and is often negative. Turn your Bibles to John chapter 11, if you haven't already, as we look into the life of this passionate pessimist. Tonight, we're going to see some interesting things that Thomas is dealing with and went through. In fact, as I was studying last night, over these last few days, and specifically today, I am so fascinated by this guy. I could probably teach for an hour and a half on this guy. I'm not going to. We don't have that kind of time. But this guy just fascinates me. It's really cool. And so tonight what we're going to look at is kind of somewhat of a hopeless outlook that he has on life. But then on the other hand, his hardcore loyalty to Christ. And how, you know, on one hand, he seemed kind of hopeless. On the other hand, he was completely sold out, devoted to Jesus Christ. When you talk about a disciple, when you talk about a follower of Jesus Christ, this guy would follow him to the death. And eventually he did. And then, of course, as you can tell, at the end of service, we're going to celebrate communion, have a time of worship. Very excited about that as well. So, number one, if you want to write some things down tonight, number one, Thomas would say there's no chance. There's no chance. There's no way out, he might say. Maybe you guys have felt like that before, felt trapped, or you felt got a little claustrophobic in a room with a bunch of people or something like that. I read about a 4-year-old boy this week who probably felt a little claustrophobic. He got trapped in his mom's washing machine, okay? It was a top-loading washing machine, so the lid comes up, and he hopped inside. And you know, do you know the thing inside? It's called the agitator. It turns all the clothes around and everything like that. Well, he got wedged in between the wall of the dryer inside and the agitator with his leg pressed up against his chest, okay? So he's like, I can't move. So eventually his mom comes in, finds him wedged in there, tries to pull him out, couldn't pull him out, had to call 911. The fire department had to come out. They had to use these things called the jaws of life. Maybe you guys know what these things are. They're normally used when there's like a rollover car accident and there's crushed and twisted metal everywhere. They normally use it to cut through car metal. But now they use this thing to cut through the washing machine because they couldn't get to this poor kid. So finally he got out. He got taken to the hospital. And then eventually, at the hospital, they checked him out. Everything was okay. They released him. They gave him a teddy bear. You know what they named the teddy bear? Agitator, since he was stuck by the agitator. Very nice. So he probably, I'm sure at some point, felt like there was no chance. Like there was no way out. Like he was never going to get past this situation. How is he going to make it out? Well, John chapter 11 is pretty interesting because Jesus and his disciples face a pretty seemingly hopeless situation. I want you guys to look with me. John chapter 11, we're going to start all the way in verse 1. Right at the beginning. John 11, verse 1. Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. Verse 2. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. So Jesus and Lazarus were really good friends. Lazarus is getting very, very sick. He's dying. And so they send and tell Jesus. Well, look at what Jesus says, verse 4. When Jesus heard that, he says, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. That's an interesting reaction when someone's sick. Oh, really? He's sick? Oh, I think I'll probably hang out here for a couple more days. That doesn't seem like a normal healing Jesus kind of move, but you'll see why he did that here in just a few minutes. Now, obviously, this is a seemingly hopeless situation. First off, Lazarus is dying. This guy's not doing good. This is not just he's sick. This guy won't make it if Jesus doesn't come. He's dying. He's perishing as they speak. Verse 3, it says that Lazarus' sisters send to Jesus to come quickly. They say, Jesus, the one whom you love, Lazarus, he's dying. Come see him. But Jesus hangs out for a little while. He delays. Now, eventually, he makes up his mind to head to this place, this town called Bethany, which is also near Judea, okay? Now, he makes up his mind to head there, but his disciples think he's crazy for going there. Look at verse 7, chapter 11. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." When you see that word again, that means they've already been there. And we'll see what happened when he went there in just a minute. Verse 8, the disciples said to him, "Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and are you going there again?" So they tell him, Jesus, hey, don't you remember? That was the place they tried to kill you. They chucked big rocks at your eye, you know? I don't think you really want to go back there. Do you really want to go there again, they asked? Well, let me take you back to what happened. If you want to flip back a couple chapters of John chapter 8, you can look in verse 58. It says, John chapter 8, 59. Then they took up stones to throw at him. So they picked up big rocks and they tried to kill Jesus by throwing stones at him. So that's a big deal. These guys try to murder Jesus. And so, I'm sorry, I've gotten distracted. Can you guys not do that on the phone? It'd be great. Thank you. So they tried to murder Jesus here. They went after him to kill him. John chapter 10, if you want to flip ahead now to John chapter 10, verse 39. Says, therefore, they sought again to seize him, but he escaped out of their hand. So again, they tried to murder him. Again, they tried to get a hold of this guy. I don't exactly know by what means this time, but they are trying to attack and kill Jesus. That's the place that Jesus now wants to go back. You could understand why Jesus' disciples would think he's crazy for wanting to go back to this city. I mean, can you imagine? If there were death threats on your life and people were attacking you, you probably wouldn't want to hang out in that city too long, don't you think? But Jesus was ready to head back. And Jesus also kind of spells out to them why he wants to go back. Look at verse 11 of John chapter 11. These things he said, and after that he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up." Okay, that's kind of interesting. Mary and Martha just said, "Hey, Jesus, you should come because Lazarus is dying." Jesus said, "Oh, he's just sleeping." Okay, verse 12. Then his disciples said, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get well." However, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought he was speaking about taking rest in sleep. So his disciples say, "Well, Jesus, why do we have to go there if he's just sleeping? I mean, he has an alarm clock. He'll wake up, right? I mean, it's not that big of a deal. We don't have to go to a different city to wake this guy up. If he's only sleeping, it's no big deal." Verse 14, then Jesus said to them plainly, "Lazarus is dead." Verse 15, "And I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him." Jesus is kind of making some crazy talk here. What is he doing? He says, "Hey, he's just sleeping. Don't worry about it." The disciples are like, "Well, if he's just sleeping, we don't need to go." And Jesus says, "Hey, guys, I'm not meaning literal sleep. This guy's dead. But it works out. I have a plan through all this that I wasn't there. There's a reason I didn't go, because I want you guys to believe in who I am." And so he has a plan through all of this. He tries to speak to them spiritually, But then he has to kind of take them by the hand and spell it out. Now they realize there's no talking Jesus out of going to Judea. His mind is set. That is where he will go. He has a plan. Have you guys ever felt like God is ignoring your prayers? Have you guys ever felt like God is delaying his answer to your prayers? Like, God, I'm getting really sick. You know, why haven't you healed me yet? I'll bet that's how Lazarus felt. I'm good friends with Jesus. This guy heals people who are paralyzed and blind and can't talk and can't walk. He heals people with leprosy. He raises people back from the dead. And Lazarus is laying at home, probably wondering where Jesus was. His sisters are there. We told Jesus to come, they might have been saying. But he's not here. What is he doing? Where is he? And they might have been getting a little worked up here. Let me tell you this. If you ever feel like Jesus is delaying in his answer to your prayer, his delay is the answer to your prayer. That's what you need to realize, because God's timing is always better than yours. And of course, we would think in this place, the best plan would be to heal Lazarus, right? That would make sense. But according to Jesus' plan, that wasn't the best plan. We're going to see why that is. Well, according to Thomas, however, there is no chance of any of them surviving if they go back to Judea. But they know Jesus' mind is set. It's made up. He will go there. In Thomas's mind, he's a pessimist. He says there's no way we're going to survive. But look at his response, verse 16. Here's the kicker with Thomas. This is the first time we read about Thomas in John. It says this, "Then Thomas, who is called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, 'Let us also go that we may die with him.'" So they realize now Jesus has his mind made up. There's a reason. Something's happening. Jesus has a plan. I don't know what it is, but Jesus' mind is set. So Thomas is like, well, sweet. We're going to die, but hey, let's do it. Let's go with Jesus. That is how devoted this guy is. Now, yeah, on one hand, he's a pessimist. I mean, obviously, he's forgetting all the miracles that he's done. Forget healing people. Forget feeding maybe 15,000 people in the wilderness with some bread and some fish. Forget Jesus walking on the water. Forget Jesus healing, you know, paralytics and leprous people. Forget all of that. Forget Jesus getting up on the deck of the boat and calming a storm. Forget all of that. Because, hey, we're going to a city where some bullies have some rocks. And here Thomas is like forgetting all of those miracles. And he's like, well, we're going to die. But hey, guys, we're committed to Jesus. Let's follow Jesus and we will die with him. So on one hand, it's very pessimistic. He has no hope that there's any chance that they will survive. On the other hand, this is hardcore loyalty. Although he sees it in kind of a negative view, he is so committed to Jesus that if Jesus is going to die, Thomas is going to be dying right next to him. That's his desire. That is how committed this guy is to Jesus. In Thomas's eyes, there's no chance of survival. But that's okay as long as he's with Jesus. As long as Jesus is nearby, that's okay. Maybe you felt like Thomas before. You're outnumbered. You feel alone. You feel like you're fighting the battle by yourself. You feel afraid. Know that God has a plan. Just like Thomas, he felt outnumbered. He felt a little fearful. But he knew God had a plan. And he was going to follow Jesus into that plan to the death. Let me tell you this. Thomas may have said that there's no chance. With God, there is always a chance. Anything is possible with God. Number two, something Thomas might have said, there's no direction. Flip a few chapters ahead to John chapter 14. There's no direction, he might have said. Now, how many of you guys in your car when you drive home, you have a GPS? Anybody? A few of you? Okay. GPS, basically, it's a global positioning system or device, I'm sorry. And it's basically computers and satellites all over the world that can pinpoint your exact location on the earth. And so in these cars, of course, that are equipped with these things, you can type in where you're going, and it will give you exact directions exactly how to get there, okay? Now, these things are getting pretty popular. I read about a few places that they are now. They're everywhere. They're in phones. They're in cameras. They're in watches. I even found out that they are in school uniforms, believe it or not. There's a company in the UK who is now marketing school uniforms with a GPS tracking device sewn into the clothing. So that when you put your pants or your skirt on, guys, not a skirt, but when you put those on and you walk out the door to school, your parents can keep track of every step you take. They can track you anywhere you go while you're wearing those. Creepy, right? But that's one thing that's on the market. I read about another interesting GPS story. At Christmas, turns out baby Jesuses were being stolen from nativities all over the place. People thought it was funny to steal baby Jesus. So in Florida, one town put a GPS in the baby Jesus, okay? So that they would always be able to know where this thing was and they could track it. Well, it got stolen. Of course, the person didn't know it had a GPS device. They tracked baby Jesus to a house. They found the girl. 18-year-old girl was arrested for stealing baby Jesus, charged with grand theft. And I think Jesus would say, that's why I made the eighth commandment. Don't steal, right? So she got caught because of the GPS. And you know, I was thinking about this idea of GPS, and especially in a car, it can be so useful so you know where you're going. You have some direction, right? Everybody needs direction, every one of us. But much more importantly than physical direction, we need spiritual direction. Every single one of us ever born was born with no hope, with no purpose, except for Jesus Christ. Apart from Jesus, you have nothing. Do you understand that? Apart from a relationship with Jesus, guys, there's no hope. Jesus is it. You have to have him. It's not an option. And so we all need that spiritual direction. Well, Thomas needed some big-time direction too. Jesus, this guy he'd been following along around for the last few years, was about to leave. Look in John chapter 13, before we get to chapter 14, verse 31. So when he had gone out, Jesus said, "Now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him immediately." Verse 33, "Little children," here's the key, "I shall be with you a little while longer. You will seek me. And as I said to the Jews, where I am going, you cannot come. So now I say to you." So he says, hey guys, I'm leaving. I'm on my way out. Where I'm going, you can't come right now. So the disciples obviously are probably a little worked up. He's just dropped some big news on them. He's just told them, first of all, right before that one of these 12 men that's gathered at this table for this last meal is going to betray him. These guys have been following Jesus around for about three and a half years now. They're best friends. And Jesus says, one of you who I'm eating with at this table is going to betray me. So that was big news right there. And then Jesus says, I'm going away. I'm leaving. So you can understand why these guys would freak out a little bit. I can't even imagine the disciples' shock. Look in chapter 14, first five verses. Jesus says, "Let not your heart be troubled." I'm sure he says that because their hearts were troubled. They were upset. "You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And where I go, you know, and the way, you know." So he tells them this. And then it's interesting what happens, because they're in a hard spot. And Thomas speaks up in verse 5. Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going, and how can we know the way? Think about it. This must have been Thomas's worst fear. Think about how loyal Thomas was to Jesus. He was so loyal that he would follow Jesus and be stoned to death with him. So you could imagine he would be a little fearful when he finds out Jesus isn't going to be there any longer. This is probably his worst fear that he's facing now. And so his reaction here, he asks this question. Again, it's a little two-sided, just like that first reaction was. It's a little two-sided. First of all, it's pretty pessimistic. He says, Jesus, you're always saying we know where to go, but we have no idea. We're lost. How in the world can we follow you? We don't know where you're going. You already said we can't go where you're going. He's really confused. It's a bit pessimistic, but he's also very loyal because he's simply stating, Jesus, I want to be where you are. Can you help me get there? Can you help me understand how it is that we can get there? Again, his question in verse 5, and how can we know the way? He says, we don't know exactly what this way is, but how can we know? Jesus, we want to be right by you. Don't leave us. I'm sure he was a bit crushed. And this simple question showed his pessimistic outlook, but also his to-the-death loyalty for Jesus. If it took him dying, he would follow Jesus. Now, I think we owe Thomas, though. We owe him eternally for this question. Because maybe without this question, we would have never gotten John chapter 14, verse 6. Check this out. Jesus said to him, you guys have all heard this, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. He says, I'm it. There's going to be a lot of points in life where you don't exactly have clear direction. You don't exactly know where you're headed or where to go. I said it this week and I'll say it again. If you can't see far ahead, go as far as you can see. Trust in Jesus that he has a plan and he's going to take you there. Go as far as God has led you to go. And when you think, you know, because we're always going to get to the place where we think we don't know the way, but we do know the way. His name's Jesus. Jesus says, I am the way. I am one of the ways, or I am a possible life, or I'm kind of the truth. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. That's it. Singular Jesus. That's it. He's the only way to go to heaven, to get to the Father. His name's Jesus. So Thomas, he used to think there's no chance of survival. He survived that. Now he thinks there's no direction to go. Jesus tells him very clear direction. But now, number three, he might say there's no proof. Turn ahead to John chapter 20. There's no proof. Now let me set the scene for you here. John chapter 14, where we just read, is before Jesus is crucified. John chapter 20 is after Jesus is crucified. So a lot of big events have happened just in these chapters in between, these few chapters. John chapter 20, verse 1, in fact, Mary Magdalene discovers Jesus' empty tomb. He's alive. He's not in the tomb anymore. He's risen. And so she discovers this, and the others now, the other disciples, are about to find out. Would you guys agree with me that part of the challenge of being a Christian is that you can't see Jesus? Is that challenging for anybody else besides me? That's hard for me sometimes. Wouldn't it be great to see Jesus? Wouldn't it be great to be able to talk one-on-one and see God face to face? Wouldn't that make it a lot easier, don't you think? But God also wants us to walk by faith, to trust in him. But we're so in need of proof all the time. We always want people to prove stuff to us. We want to touch it, see it, hear it, to believe it. We need that proof. It's probably because we live in a world that we can't trust anyone. That a lot of people are lying or there's false advertising. That reminded me of a story my sister told me. She was in school one time, maybe first, second grade. She asked her teacher if she could go get a drink. So the water fountain was right outside the classroom door. She went to get a drink. For whatever reason, I don't think my sister always did this, but for whatever reason, she drank the water and kept it in her mouth like this. So she walked back to the classroom, water in her mouth. Just walking around like that, okay? She comes back in the classroom, and the teacher's like, you don't have water in your mouth. And she's like, And she really did have water in her mouth. Teacher wouldn't believe her. So she finally said, Kara, come up here. So Kara's like, Walks up there, right? Teacher's like, you don't really have water in your mouth. She's like, And so the teacher goes like that, squeezes her cheeks. She spits water all over the teacher's face. She probably should have believed my sister, don't you think? But don't we live in a world where we don't trust people, where we always have to be looking for proof? So often we can't believe something if we don't see it. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1 says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That faith. 2 Corinthians 5, 7, I mentioned it, for we walk by faith, not by sight. That's one of the challenging things about being a Christian, is that we can't always see ahead of us, but we have to trust. God's told us to trust in him. Well, John chapter 20, verses 24 through 25, is where Thomas earns his nickname, Doubting Thomas. Let's go ahead and read that. John chapter 20, starting in verse 24. It says, now Thomas, called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them, the other disciples, when Jesus came. The other disciples therefore said to him, we have seen the Lord. You could understand why they'd be pretty excited. So he said to them, unless I see in his hands the print of the nails and put my finger into the print of the nails and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. He says, really? You've seen Jesus, huh? Because everybody else is telling me he's dead. In fact, he's in a tomb right now. You're telling me he joined you in a room? Are you kidding me? I won't believe it till I see it. He says, no way. Until I see his scars, until I can touch him, I'm not believing. There's no proof. Prove it to me, he may have said. And this is where people start dissing on Thomas. Like, come on, man. He's got to have faith, right? I mean, you're a disciple. You got to believe in Jesus. You got to have faith, okay? Yeah, maybe you should have had some faith. But Mark chapter 16 points out something pretty interesting. You don't have to flip there. But Mark chapter 16, verses 9 through 11, points out a pretty important point. It says, now, when he rose early on the first day of the week, this is Jesus, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven demons. Verse 10, she went and told those who had been with him as they mourned and wept. Now, she's speaking to the other disciples. Check this out. And when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they did not believe. Jesus' other 10 disciples had the exact same reaction that Thomas did. But yet Thomas was the one who earned the nickname Doubting Thomas. Every single follower of Christ, these amazing men of faith that we're studying, not one of them believed that Jesus was alive until they saw it for themselves. And yet Thomas was the one who walked away with the nickname. Now there's only 11 disciples left at this point. Judas, who had betrayed Jesus, had already committed suicide. He hanged himself. There's 11 guys left. And out of those 11, unfortunately, Thomas gets the nickname, even though they all reacted the same. Now, where was Thomas? Maybe you're wondering. It says that they were meeting in an upstairs room. Thomas wasn't there. Jesus appeared. So where was Thomas? Well, maybe he was in a place that many of us find ourselves in. Depressed. Doubting. Trying to fight it alone. Maybe he was in that place. Let's be honest. Some of us end up there sometimes, don't we? People struggle with cutting themselves, suicidal thoughts, taking anger and frustration out in the wrong way, rebelling because they don't know where else to turn. They don't know what else to do. That's maybe where Thomas found himself, by himself, frustrated, feeling depressed, betrayed. Jesus, however, wanted to change his attitude. I love what he does. Verse 26, John chapter 20, verse 26. And after 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas with them. So 11 guys, they're up in a room, they're all hanging out together. Thomas is finally with them. This is 8 days later. Jesus came, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst and said, "Peace to you." I love that Jesus says that as his first thing into the room. Imagine this. There's 11 of you, 10 of you and 10 of your closest friends. You're hanging out in a room, all the doors locked. All of a sudden, Jesus, "Hey, peace be to you." You think you'd be peaceful if Jesus just showed up when the doors are locked? Probably be a little freaked out, right? But Jesus shows up in the middle of all of it, doors locked. "Peace be to you," he says. But check out what he says next, verse 27. Then he said to Thomas, notice he turns immediately to Thomas, "Reach your finger here and look at my hands, and reach your hand here and put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing." And Thomas answered and said to him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Thomas, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." So there's 11 disciples locked in a room, and all of a sudden, Jesus is there. He greets them, and then I love what happens. I just picture Jesus standing there, his eyes scan the room, and there he finds Thomas. And he says, "Hey, Thomas, here's the proof. This is how much I love you right here. I did this for you. Do you see these scars? You see the nail hole through my foot? You see this wound in my side? This is for you, Thomas. Do you believe now?" Wow. And did you see Thomas's reaction? "My Lord and my God." I'm sure he felt terrible for not believing when the disciples had told him. But now he believes. He says, "My Lord and my God." And Jesus responds. Again, verse 29, he says, "Thomas, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Whenever I've read that before, when I hear about Jesus talking to these people who have believed without seeing, I've always just thought that he was referring to the other disciples for some reason. But he's not at all, because these other disciples had the same reaction as Thomas. You know who I think Jesus is referring to here when he says, "Blessed are those who don't see him yet believe"? You know who he's referring to? You and me. Because he knows thousands of years down the road, there's going to be a group of middle school students sitting in the plex of Calvary Albuquerque. And they're not going to have the proof that Thomas had that day. We are not going to be able to come up and touch Jesus' scars. We're not going to have that physical proof. But Jesus says, "Blessed are those who don't have to see to believe." Thomas, you've seen it. You've seen the proof. Blessed are those who don't have to see it. So the disciples eventually would be the last people on the earth to see Jesus before he returned to heaven. Later on in Acts chapter 1, he would ascend into heaven and they would stand there like this, watching Jesus go up. And then an angel would say, "Hey, what are you guys doing? Get going. Remember what Jesus told you? Go make disciples. Share the gospel." And they'd be like, "Oh yeah. Okay, we'll do that," you know? They watch Jesus ascend into heaven. They would be the last people to see him on earth. And their job would be to go and tell everybody about him without having the physical evidence to prove him. That's a hard job. They would have to go tell everybody about a guy who they can't see anymore. Man, that's a tough job. It's one thing to say, "Hey, you guys should come check out this guy named Jesus. He's a great teacher. He does all these miracles." People could follow him and watch things happen. But now they say, you got to believe in Jesus. You can't see him. There's no physical proof yet. But one day he'll return. They didn't have that proof. One day we'll all have that proof. Now here's the thing. Just like Thomas, some of you don't believe that Jesus is relevant to your life. There were certain points, I think, that Thomas, he doubted. He was pessimistic. And let's be honest, some of you are in here tonight. You've never made a decision to follow Christ. You don't want to. You didn't come here to change anything tonight. And you don't think that Jesus is really that relevant to you. All right, keep thinking that. I don't know how you plan on getting to heaven, because Jesus said he's the only way. So if you want to try to find a different way, go for it, but there is no other path. Jesus is it. And just like that meeting in the upper room, no one has to tell Jesus about your doubt. He sees it. And I think that if Jesus were to physically walk into these doors today, I think just like he appeared in that room and scanned until he saw Thomas and gave him the proof, I think he would do the same thing today if he came here. I think if he were to walk in this door, he would turn to whoever it is in this room who doesn't believe, and he would say, hey guys, here's the proof. This is it. This is how much I love you. This is what I did for you. I took the pain that you deserved to take. And so for those of you in here who have never made that decision to follow Christ, and you've lived part of most of your life thinking that Jesus is not relevant to your life, I challenge you to think about that again, because he is so relevant to your life. In fact, he's the only one who gives you life. Without him, there is no life. Now, a lot of people made up a bunch of theories about Jesus' resurrection. They say one theory is that he never died. You know, he never died. So they buried him, but eventually he started feeling better, took some ibuprofen maybe, you know, and just woke up and walked out of the tomb. That's one theory. First of all, it's medically impossible that Jesus could have stayed alive from what he went through. There's no way. So that's one theory. Second theory is, or another theory is, that somebody stole his body. That they laid him in the tomb, and somebody, maybe some of the disciples, wanted to say that Jesus rose again, so they snuck in, all 007 style. And while the Roman guards weren't watching, they lifted Jesus out, and who knows what they did with him, but all of a sudden he was gone. Mystical, right? That's what some people say. Not going to happen. Had these Roman guards allowed somebody in there, every one of them would have been slaughtered immediately. There's no way that these disciples would have done that. And then there's a lot of other theories about what happened and all of these things. Some people even say that they just went to the wrong tomb. They're like, oh yeah, I think this was the one, right, that Jesus was in? Oh, looks like nobody's here. He must have risen. But actually, Jesus was next door in the tomb, is what they say. Not at all. Jesus was alive. Jesus rose back from the grave. And here, I think in my mind, one of the biggest proofs that Jesus really was alive is how the disciples changed their lives. John chapter 20, verse 19, that's the meeting when Jesus appears to the 10 without Thomas there. John chapter 20, verse 19, it says that the disciples are locked in an upper room, doors shut, doors locked, and it says they're up there locked in the room because they're afraid of the Jews. They're scared. Jesus is dead. They don't know what to do. But then Jesus appeared, and everything drastically changed. Because eventually, 10 of the 11 remaining disciples died horrible, torturous deaths for their testimony, to tell other people about Jesus. And Thomas's words, "Let us also go that we may die with him," they came true one day. They didn't come true the day that he thought they would, but years later, eventually, after he had started a bunch of churches, history has recorded that he ended up in India after years of preaching the gospel, going everywhere, telling people about Jesus. Eventually, he was attacked by angry people that hated him for the message he was proclaiming. They ran him through with spears, and they burned him in an oven. This is the way that Thomas died. And here this guy says, "Let us also go that we may die with him." What a fitting way for him to go. Tonight, Jesus wants to take your doubt away. And I think he would say the same thing that he said to Thomas. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. So I'm going to have Ray come up here. We have some time right now to close in a time of worship. And here's what I want you guys to do. I want you guys to focus here. If anything, if there's ever a more important time in our service, this is it. Because right now, you can hit the lights. Right now, in just a few moments, we're going to not only worship like we started out the service, but we're going to have an opportunity to come up to these tables. And guys, this is nothing to take lightly. This is nothing, this table, this bread, this juice is not something to take lightly. God's word talks about the importance of it. It talks about preparing your hearts, making sure that your hearts are right before you come up and take this. Because basically what you're doing when you come up to this table and you don't agree that Jesus really died for your sins or you don't care, you're making a mockery of what Jesus did. You're laughing at him, basically. You might as well spit in his face. That's how big of a deal this is. But here's the great thing. Here's what I love about communion, is that so many people think communion is about having a funeral for Jesus, you know? Like, oh, wow, this is a special memorial, remembering what a great man Jesus was. Sure, he was a great man, but he's also God, and he's still alive today. And we could see it evidenced in the lives of these men that followed him. As they saw him, as they witnessed who this guy was, back from the dead, they saw his scars. They saw holes in his hand. Can you imagine looking through your hand like this from a hole? Jesus could do that because these nails were driven through his hand and through his feet and a sword into his side. He took that for us. So in just a moment, you're going to have an opportunity to come up here to these tables. And all you got to do is take a simple little piece of bread, break that off. It's a picture. It's a symbol of Jesus' broken body for you. And then as you dip it into that juice and you see that juice dripping off of there, I want you to think that that's Jesus' blood that he shed for you and for me. And we are just as guilty as the actual men who pounded Jesus to the cross. Because had it not been for our sins, Jesus would have never had to die. So we're going to pray. And then we have plenty of time for worship. Leaders will be available around the room as always. But guys, I really want you to take advantage of that. And actually, we're going to do something a little different tonight. When we start worship, I'm going to ask the leaders to come right up here to the front. And I want you guys to understand that we are here to help you guys. Maybe you need prayer. Maybe there's a sin that you need to confess. Maybe there's a struggle you don't know how to get past. Maybe life at home is rough. You're going through divorce. Your parents are fighting. You're fighting with them. You're fighting with brothers and sisters or friends. Maybe it's a struggle. Maybe it's a sin. Whatever it is, we want to be here to pray for you, pray with you, point you in the right direction. Tonight, Jesus wants to remove your doubt. And maybe you find yourself in a place like Thomas where you're pessimistic. You always have a doubtful outlook on life. It doesn't have to end that way tonight. Know that God has a plan no matter which way your life may turn, no matter how your plans may change. So we're going to close in prayer. We'll have a time of worship. And I encourage you guys, don't rush to this table. Take advantage of the time that we have. Spend some time right at your seat, not talking to another person, but talking to Jesus, because he paid this price for you. And if you need us leaders are going to be up here to pray for you. Let's pray. Jesus, we think about you so much tonight as we have this opportunity not only to close in a time of worship, but continue and further our worship as we take communion. As we get to just rip off a little piece of bread, it reminds us, Jesus, that you were beaten up for us. As they ripped out your beard and they spat in your face and they whipped your back, all of those things were for us. And your body was literally broken for us. And then as we dip that bread into the juice, it becomes saturated with that red juice. It reminds us, Jesus, that you shed your blood. It poured down the splintered cross for us. And had it not been for your choice to get on that cross and allow people to do that to you, we would have no hope and we would never be able to get to heaven. Jesus, tonight, would you change people's hearts? Would you take away the doubt that people have? And for anybody in here tonight, Jesus, that has that mindset that I'm not doing anything until Jesus proves himself to me, would you prove yourself to them tonight? Open our hearts and help us to hear from you. In your name we pray. Amen.